No one's saying no, so I'm going to assume that it's yes. Please, first of all, don't call me Dr. Kluber. All a doctorate means is that I wrote a very long essay a few years ago. But I'm really pleased to be here today to talk about some of the challenges and difficulties and some ideas and thoughts around really including AIDS-affected young people in OBC research, not just as participants or as the subject of research, but as really active engagers in designing and thinking about informing the research directly. And I'd like to thank the Teal Advisory Group. They've not only contributed all the photos for this presentation, but they've also been engaged in thinking with us about how we should be working with children in planning research. So why include children at all in the design and planning of OVC research? And I think I'm going to go through this quite quickly because I think we're all of the same mind that this is something that would be ideal to do. And there's a bunch of ethical reasons why. There's the Convention of the Rights of the Child, which is often referred to. There's also a whole set of, and you can see I've put these set of words below in green because they're often referred to as spinach words. They're spinach words because everyone knows that they're good. And these are things like partnership and power sharing and reducing inequalities between AIDS-affected populations and the people who work with and for them. And yet the real challenges come when we think about how to do that. There's also a whole set of scientific reasons why it can be really helpful to include children in OVC research. And this is actually very much less talked about, but certainly we found that our teen advisory group have prevented us from making stupid mistakes in some of our research, but also they've helped us think about different and important things that we should be studying. Oh, and just because whenever I go to a webinar, I always wonder what the person looks like. And the person in the green t-shirt over there, that's me. So you've got a mental picture in your head, and one of the girls in our teen advisory group. So what's the real picture? We know that we should be doing research which involves children, but you know, what does it really look like on the ground? And RECSE is actually at the moment doing some really interesting work on child participation, mainly programmatically rather than research. But I'd really recommend anyone who's interested to get in touch with them. It's still in progress, but some really interesting kind of putting things together. But the reality in research is that child participation is very rarely done. And when I agreed to do this webinar, I set three students off to find everything they possibly could that was published about child participation in research. And in terms of actual reports of studies that have been done, I think they've probably found four or five worldwide. So it's really rarely done. Where it is done, it seems to have been almost universally done with qualitative research. And this has included kind of youth-led research, who where they've identified the topic, helped design the research, been involved directly in data collection, which of course has ethical questions around whether that's possible for all studies, and also analysis of data and dissemination of findings. But I think there's still real questions around how this kind of model, which is really in a sense designed for small-scale, qualitative, peer-led research, fits the kind of quantitative large-scale research and the monitoring and evaluation work that we do and that we increasingly are needing to do as part of working in the OVC world, which is part of the wider, very biomedical, quantitatively based world of research on HIV. No one's asked me any questions yet, so don't be too polite. If something comes up that you don't understand or you disagree with, do say. So what I wanted to talk to you about today was some of the mistakes and some of our group's successes in what we've tried to do in terms of child participation in our research. And really, I'd prefer this to be a conversation because I don't think that we've got the answers. In fact, I think in lots of cases, all we've done is create more questions for ourselves. But I hope that this example can help us think about how this might be possible and how we can improve it on a wider scale. And I think an example is look at the pictures on the left of here, the photos. This was part of an exercise that our teen advisory group requested. That's what the tag team is short for. And they said, could they take a camera home and take photos of their everyday lives? And this was part of a wider project that they were doing. And when they came back, one of the photos was the one on the very top of those three here. And one girl had just returned 24 photos of this tent. And it was only really when we developed them and looked at them carefully that we realized what this was. It was her mother's funeral. And she'd taken the camera home, and her mother had died the next day. And she'd taken 24 photos of her life, and every single one of them of her mother. And I think that helps us think about some of the unanticipated things that come up and the unanticipated consequences of really doing child participatory research. Can you hear me, everyone? Am I too quiet? Okay, I'm going to try and speak a little bit louder. Don't seem to have fabulous sound. Is that any better? Okay, I'll keep going. Oh, good. Okay, that's better. I'll speak like I'm speaking to my large crowd of students, nice and loud. So the research that I'm going to talk about and the wider context of this research is a set of collaborative orphans and vulnerable children research, which is a collaboration between, oh, thank you, you're all writing that it's good, it's a collaboration between a set of South African government departments, major NGOs and smaller scale NGOs, so both local and international NGOs. Universities, particularly Oxford, but also South African universities, UCT, University of KZN and WITS, and also the Teen Advisory Group, who are designed in this kind of thinking about our research to really be a key input into what goes into the research, how the research is conducted, what we analyze for the research, and who and how we disseminate the findings. Now, the complexity comes in as how does that really work? Because I think we have very good structures for doing this with government departments or with NGOs. You know, you fly to New York to meet with UNICEF, or you go to Pretoria to meet with government, and you have a high-level meeting in which you discuss intensively what you're doing in the research. But does this work in the same way with a group of AIDS-affected children? Clearly not. So the actual studies that this teen advisory group have worked very closely on, I'm going to talk mainly about two studies, both of them linked, and these studies have interviewed a total of 8,000 children in South Africa. One is the Developing World's first longitudinal study of AIDS-affected children, and that followed 1,000 children over 4 years. They started off living in deprived Cape Flats areas, and now they live all over the country. And the second is called the National Young Carer Study. And this interviewed 6,002 children and then followed up 97% of them a year later. And it also interviewed 2,600 of their caregivers. And this is very much quantitative research. It's large, stratified samples with national samples. The kind of analysis and work we do from it is you know, fairly complex statistical analysis. So how do we really bring in a group of children who've experienced very difficult, often upbringings and very delayed education, and are experiencing very difficult lives, into and engaged with this research? So this is a picture from our last teen advisory group weekend. Don't be fooled by the sunshine. We mistimed this one, and it was actually freezing icy cold, and we all froze at night. And the main complaint that the kids had in our final evaluation was need more blankets next time. But if you have a look at this photo, there's a couple of things about it that I'm going to come back to and point out, which were really mistakes that we made. So what are some of the lessons that we've learned about the teen advisory group and working with kids? The first one is that the kind of adult idea of a meeting doesn't work. You know, we've managed to, I mean, with a little bit, maybe 15, 20 minutes delay, we've all managed to get in the same place, get connected, or at least get in the same place to engage in this discussion. But with these kids who live all over urban and rural areas of the Western Cape of South Africa, they have no access to transport. Most of them don't have cell phones. Quite often, no one in their household has a cell phone. There's no postal, reliable post. And so just the logistical challenge of getting them all into one place at one time means that it's not going to work to do this for 2 hours or 4 hours or even a day. Essentially, we've realized we have to do this as weekends away. And actually, the first weekend away was a complete trial. And at the end of it, we'd never intended on doing it again. And at the end of it, all the kids said, what date's next year's weekend? And we realized we really had to do it again. But so some of the real logistical things to think about are transport for kids from distant areas who don't have access to cell phones, and especially if they're living in slum or informal settlement areas. It's quite a complex logistical exercise, and it needs to be approached with, I would say, the skills of a program and project manager, not the skills of a researcher. The other thing that we learned really by mistake about the importance of a weekend is that it gives time. The kids need time to relax. They need time to trust the group, and they need time to trust you as researchers or as programmers. We also found, particularly for the kids who were gangsters, that they needed a good day and a half to kind of drop the cool. They came with a real attitude. And it was only really, you know, if we started at lunchtime on a Friday, it's only really by Saturday night that they're starting to relax and feel able to really openly discuss the things that they're doing. And I don't think that's just about kids being cool. It's also about the fact that many of these kids have had to develop real survival mechanisms. And often part of those survival mechanisms have been building up a kind of shell around yourself, a protective shell. And it really, for these kids, having a weekend away, often out in the countryside, was an opportunity to drop those. It's also for these kids really important, in a kind of therapeutic way, to have time away from their very stressful home environments, and time when they can engage with other kids and engage with sympathetic adults. And I think we underestimated just how important that was for them. I mean, you'll see actually the picture there. We took some of the kids in our last year's camp on a walk in the mountains, and we were a bit worried because they get quite nervous about things like that. But they actually, for them, it was one of the things that they most enjoyed, was the sense of freedom and achievement of walking through the mountains. We actually didn't go very far, but they felt it was a huge thing. It's also worth thinking about safety concerns. And certainly we found that trying to do work in the environments where the kids were actually living was beset by a whole range of safety concerns, particularly because these were often very high crime, gang-ridden areas. And it just made everything easier to get out, both kind of mentally and physically. It's worth thinking about an enormous amount and building in an enormous amount of organization time. We average about 10 hours of planning per hour of time with the kids. We need a team of people to do the organization for these weekends. It doesn't work to have just one. And what's really important is to do extensive preparatory work with the kids. And we'll go and visit them. We'll visit their families. We'll remind them that we're going on the tag weekend. You know, for these kids, often time and dates aren't necessarily very closely followed. And so it's really valuable to, you know, go and visit a week before and go and visit 2 days before and check things are okay. And sometimes that where that really comes up as important is where last-minute crises happen for these kids. For example, last time, two of our kids who'd just had babies, two 14-year-old girls had both arranged childcare, and at the last minute, both of their childcare fell through, and we were able to make a plan, say, bring the kids, and that was only allowed by that kind of ongoing preparatory work. What's also really, we found really important, is being really quite serious about making it fun. And if you don't make it fun, and if you don't make it engaging, the kids aren't going to either enjoy what they're doing or really give you valuable findings. And so we try to make even the serious stuff active and interesting. Now, that doesn't always work, because sometimes the serious things that we're talking about are so emotionally difficult that they just need to be addressed. They can't really be addressed in as fun a way. What we've also discovered is that kids really value having input into what happens in next year's camp, and they really value that. And you can actually see on the right-hand side an example of one of the activities that we did. We set them up as presidential planning committees. They were plan they given a budget of Monopoly money, and they planned out what they were going to spend in a following year. And you can see that these kids have done really quite sophisticated analyses of what they would be spending the national budget on. I think we only gave them 20 million to spend. The other thing that we've discovered is absolutely crucial is getting the food right. One of our disasters was a year in which we went to a holiday camp where the camp provided the food, and the kids really hated the food. So we've learned that lesson. That's very important. There's also a whole set of safety and ethical concerns that we have to really keep in mind. One of them is that particularly when you're working with teenagers, you need to think quite hard about sexual safety. And just very practical things like having adult supervisors sleeping in the tents or the camp rooms of the boys and girls to make sure there's no crossover. And actually, some of the things that have been really helpful in that is creating a very structured and safe set of rules that the kids are very familiar with and feel quite comfortable within. And I think that helps. It's also worth thinking that some of these kids are going to be on antiretroviral therapy and that you do need to make preparatory plans to include that in the camp and make sure, for example, that you've got fridges and things like that to keep them. We also think about getting consent and informed consent from kids and their guardians, if they have them, to take part in this research. And actually, we get consent so many times, and particularly for a film that the Teen Advisory Group recently made, that one of the comments the kids wrote last year was, "Please stop asking me consent. I really do want to do this." So maybe we're over careful. Another thing that's really worth thinking about that we've battled with, and this is a problem that comes up particularly with focus groups and qualitative research, is how do you ensure confidentiality beyond the weekend? We can establish within the weekend that there's no bullying, and that what people say is treated in a kind of confidential and empathetic way. But what happens when these kids go out into the wider community? And can we encourage kids to disclose things like parental HIV status? When other kids will then be going out into their communities and we just don't have control over whether they tell anyone. And I think what we've ended up doing, we started off being very careful about that. And what really has happened is that the teen advisory group have developed almost a pact. They didn't know each other at the start, but they seem to have developed almost a pact whereby they don't tell anyone outside the group about why all of these kids are in this group, and they haven't disclosed about each other's family status to anyone else, and that's worked. I don't know if it would always work. And I just put an example at the bottom. I think this is another example of a failure. We were worried a couple of years ago about sexual risk for our teen advisory group. So we did a whole how to do condoms and sexual safety session. You can see them down there putting condoms on bananas. It was a dismal failure because two of the six girls came back the next year with babies. So I think we'd need to work on getting that better. So what kind of child input does work and has worked in research? It's crucial to work on the kids' level when you're doing this. And you'll see to the right some examples of things that they've done. The picture at the bottom is part of an exercise where we were testing out different questions that we would ask kids and asking them whether these questions were acceptable to ask in survey research. So you see, we had three trees and each tree had a poster stuck to it, and the poster said, "Go ahead, be careful, and don't ask." And that's a go ahead thing, tree. And they've said yes to lots of different questions that we asked. And then, of course, the ones that they said don't ask or be careful, the kids then helped us to rephrase those questions. You'll also see underneath that there's an exercise called Super Teens Tasks. And this was an exercise that we did in the style of a kind of Superman exercise, but where they talked about the kind of activities that they did in looking after AIDS sick caregivers. And this actually directly inputted into our national survey of young carers. So kids have been instrumental in designing study tools. They're also really great at pilot testing instruments and the kind of survey designs that we do. They are at the moment really crucial in planning two of our new studies. One of them's looking at antiretroviral adherence for adolescents, and the other one's two we have looking at prevention of child abuse. And they've been really key in thinking about how to do those studies. They've also been really instrumental in post-research programming. And what's happened is, and a great example of this is that last year, REPSI, the Regional Psychosocial Support Initiative, came back to the TAG weekend and said, we've taken the results from this research and we've used it to design programmatic guidance for young carers of AIDS-affected parents. And then they pilot tested and discussed that programmatic guidance with the teen advisory group. And I think this had dual advantages. One was that it allowed kids input into programming, but secondly, that it really allowed the kids to see the actual results of what they had been doing over the years. What I think we haven't done as well is thinking about dissemination and how to involve kids in a meaningful way and not just a tokenistic way in disseminating findings. And one of the ways the kids chose to do it was through a movie. I mean, if you go on, I'll show the website at the end, you can click and look at the Teen Advisory Group movie. But really, I just don't think we've worked out how to do that yet, and I'd value people's opinions. And of course, while you're doing this child input into research, it's really important to include soccer games and craft activities. Talent shows are hugely popular, and there's a key element of marshmallows, which I'll talk about a bit later. So what are some of the questions that we still can't answer? And I think this is certainly where I'd value discussion and thought. One of the questions is around the fact that these are not just any children. These are children who've experienced intense and often ongoing life trauma. And we've really had to think quite carefully, and we don't have answers, around what does this mean for disclosure? And we'll have children in the teen advisory group who will say for the first time to anyone that they're living with an AIDS-affected parent, or that their parent has died of AIDS, or that they're HIV positive themselves. And often, teen advisory group members have disclosed their HIV status to us before they've disclosed it to their parents or families. We've also had some confusing times, and particularly at the beginning, when one of the children wasn't aware that their parent had HIV. They were aware that they were very unwell. And after sitting around the campfire and hearing a discussion from other children, the child said, I realize now my mother has HIV. And I think we really hadn't planned for or anticipated some of these consequences. There's also questions about protecting kids, and particularly when some of these issues that kids discuss and want to discuss are also really upsetting. And sometimes this will come out in funny ways. You know, the kids will have a whole discussion, and then two of the girls will have a fight afterwards about nothing. And you'll see that this is really about expressing and realizing this great trauma that they're experiencing. And you'll see on the right that we make the rules at the beginning of each camp with the kids, and that's been quite helpful to have a sort of kid-based and kid-derived set of rules, although obviously we guide them a bit for some of them. And then there's a real question about whether we're getting the same things out of this. I think it's clear that we're getting a huge amount of value for our research. But when we ask the kids what they get out of it, it's kind of 50-50. 50% they like being involved in the study, but 50% they just really like going away for a weekend. And you can see the boy just in the front of the picture there has his mouth stuffed with so many marshmallows that his complaint was that he felt sick at the end of this. There are some more questions we still can't answer. And one of them is about the relationship that's built and the responsibilities that we feel as a research team. And I think this has just come up more and more. What do you do when you go away on weekends with these kids? You build up a relationship, you build a sense of responsibility, and then everything goes wrong in these kids' lives. And we found ourselves, you know, I found myself taking kids to the magistrate's court to try and sort out when they've had their property grabbed by a relative because their parents have died. We found ourselves taking kids to antiretroviral clinics, getting them tested for HIV, bullying the clinics to provide them with antiretrovirals. We found ourselves writing to schools. We found ourselves getting bursaries for these kids. And really, I think we haven't solved the question in our mind of these kids are clearly not research participants. But where are they? What are they to us, and what are we to them? And they certainly see us as protectors in a way. We also have questions about what do we do when these kids grow up. And our teen advisory group, some of them are now getting to like 19, 20, and yet they don't want to stop being part of the teen advisory group. And I think we still have real questions about how to manage that. We also have questions about funding and building the teen advisory group into long-term funding. And at the moment, you know, really we fund our teen advisory groups in a kind of mad dash each year. And quite often I'll end up taking a consultancy job or a, you know, giving a talk where I get a speaker fee and then just pumping that money into the next tag team weekend. But I don't think that's a good and sustainable approach. There's also real questions about real empowerment and real dissemination. And I don't think we've yet addressed those questions of how, to what extent are we really empowering these kids? They're still living in these really difficult home situations. And, you know, you can see from the quote at the bottom that the research, that we also have different expectations. And one of the kids, and we've changed all the names, said that they found that this research is positive to help them with their problems at home. And when we asked, you know, what do you mean? It was partly that it very much helped them to hear about other kids and hear the research findings, but partly also that they felt that there was some kind of direct support for them. And really there was. And I think an example of a successful engagement with the teen advisory group was this paper that came out in Journal of AIDS, but also really was used to get a lot of policy impact with UNICEF, with UNAIDS, and other organizations. And this came about from a conversation I had around a campfire one night with a girl in our teen advisory group who was talking about what happened when her parents got very sick. And she essentially explained that she'd had to go out and get a sugar daddy in order to pay for the school. And this really got us as researchers thinking, can we look at this quantitatively? And if you'll see here, you can see this is from a study of 1,000 kids. You can see on the left that girls who live in a healthy family, who aren't abused and who have enough to eat, have a just under 1% chance of having transactional sex, being exploited in transactional sex. If you look to the right-hand side, you'll see that a girl who has an AIDS-sick parent is abused and hungry has a 57% chance of having transactional sex. And this really is, I think, an example of where you can translate their experience into research and then into policy impact. So here are some very useful links that we found. I've also found a whole load more in the last few days, so do ask me, send me an email if you want me to send you anything. A big thank you to our funders who have either knowingly or inadvertently funded the Teen Advisory Group. And I'd just like to end not with me, but with them and the comments that they've made, because certainly we found that inspiring in carrying on this often quite stressful process. And they ended, and this was something that they wrote without us asking at the end of one of the tag weekends. And I think really what it said to us is that this is a process that we haven't yet got right, but that we need to keep trying until we do get it right. So let's open this up for discussion and comment, and criticism would be really valued as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Lucy. So all of you see that the screen has changed. Feel free to type in your questions if you have them. And or comments or suggestions or thoughts that you have about this. Also, in the top left corner, there's a raise your hand button if you would rather speak your question. That's fine, and we can enable your microphone if you'd like to do that.
Right, so Sarah said, have we had any experience involving younger children in similar processes of informing and guiding research? research. The youngest kids in our teen advisory group were about 12 when they started. And actually, sometimes now we get 10-year-olds because the kids bring their younger brothers and sisters. And our youngest members are only about 6 months old because they're the children of our teen advisory group. We certainly find with younger children that they need much more intensive pastoral care. And that they, I'm not sure it always works to have the younger, very much younger children and the older teenagers together doing all of the activities. We're still struggling with working out how to do that, although the younger ones very much emulate the older ones, and the older ones are quite sort of parental almost towards the younger ones. Are there good ways of doing this for, say, 5 to 9-year-olds? I just don't know. We haven't tried, and I think we'd be nervous to try. And we've not really found very good anything where anyone's written about how to do that effectively. So, no, I don't know how we would do that. But I'd really value if anyone has good ideas about how to. Absolute pleasure, sir. You're all being very polite. Well, I've also got a question for you as a group, which is, has anyone else been trying this you know about, and is there any opportunity to reach out to other organizations who are trying to do this? And I'd really value to know that. I think we're really hopeful to learn, and also maybe to start publishing something on this, start giving some guidance. Mike's asked, how do you balance the need to help the children with your research objectives and goals? I mean, I think you've identified the struggle that we have that's really at the heart of where we're stuck. Because, you know, in a sense, your research objective is to engage children in a similar way to the way that you're engaging government and NGOs in saying, how can we make this research relevant for children? But equally, how can we be asking the right questions? And of course, doing that is about engaging in-depth discussion and thought about the issues of OVC. Now, of course, I think a real challenge there is that delving into those deep and those really in-depth issues can be quite distressing for kids. Although they certainly feel also that it's very it's very liberating to be able to discuss them in a safe environment. But then we hit these problems again of this kind of the feeling that we have, which is desperately wanting to help these kids who we're all now really fond of, and who we really do feel a personal relationship with. And I think, you know, any pretense that we're maintaining a kind of research distance have long gone. I mean, we'll pretty much do anything we can to help these kids. And I think the awful thing is that even though we seem to be doing an enormous amount, their lives are still really going very wrong. It doesn't always, you know, often we're just reactive trying to shore up some of the things that go wrong. So So I guess in many ways we feel that although we've crossed that line and we're doing a lot, we're not, this is not now a group of kids who are in great situations. A couple of them are doing okay. The rest are in a tough, bad state. And I guess that's about how you balance being a professional and a person. Gosh, I don't know.
I just wanted to do a final check. Do we have any other questions? If so, please either raise your hand or type the questions. If not, we're going to go ahead and wrap up the webinar. And thank you so much, Lucy, for being with us today. And I really appreciate your presentation. And but again, just one last call for questions. We'll give a couple, just a couple minutes, and then we'll close up.
Well, if people don't have direct questions, I would like to, please do feel free to contact me or contact Young Carers research team if things come up when you go home or things that you think about. And also you'll see on the final blue screen at the bottom the web address. If you want to have a look at what the Teen Advisory Group put together and the movie that they planned and designed and filmed and edited and put together, it might tell you a little bit about that process for them. They don't actually talk much about being in the Teen Advisory Group. What they really wanted to do from that was convey to the world what the experiences were like of living in a family affected by HIV and AIDS. And they've also asked that we really convey that to as many people as possible. We've got one more question though from Mike, which is, apart from the weekend out with the teens, how do we follow them up throughout the year? And now this is a great question actually, because we've kind of developed over the years ways of doing this, and I think it's going to be really different depending on where your teen advisory or where your advisory group are from and where you're based, and kind of access to cell phones and things. We try and get in touch with them at least twice a year just to kind of see how they are, and actually that involves getting in the car and driving until you find them. And often we'll get to where they live and find that they've been thrown out of home or they've left or something's gone wrong, and we'll have to go and find them elsewhere. A couple of them have cell phones and they text us to say hello, and we keep in touch with them. And it also depends what we're doing that year. So the year that they devised this movie and did this movie, we were in touch with them almost the whole year because, you know, we were going to see them and getting cameras from them and kind of planning and devising the movie. So it's a real mishmash. We don't have a good, consistent way of doing it. And sometimes their parents or their foster parents ring us up just to say hello as well. So I do know other groups who do other kinds of research where they have much more set standard ways. For example, what's a really good thing that we haven't done, that we should actually, is having a database with everyone's birthday on it and making sure you get in touch with everyone on their birthday, and kids and people really appreciate that. So I think that would be something we could try and think about doing. I don't think we've got a great way of doing that, and I think we could learn from others about how to do that better. We are in touch with them a lot, though.
Okay, well, thank you everyone for joining, and again, thank you, Lucy, for being with us today. And we will make the recording of this session available on both the Child Status Network website and the Measure Evaluation website. And if you do think of other questions, feel free to send